Today's guest is a skipper of a round-the-world yacht race sailing 40,000 miles across the globe. He'd not met his team before, he had no say in who they were, and there was 27 different nationalities. Their ages ranged from 17 to 63, and most of them had never sailed before. Can you imagine that? But in the middle of a North Pacific hurricane, he had to leave the boat, and leaving the team to it, but they won anyway. Welcome to The Debrief, Joe. I'm your host, Steve Clayton, a multi-award-winning executive coach and trainer. And The Debrief Show is all about bringing out the best in you, your teams, and your communications. Our guest today is Brendan Hall. He's one of 10 in the world who led the winning team of the Clipper round the world yacht race, despite being the youngest and least experienced skipper. He's author of Team Spirit and an international keynote speaker talking about leadership and team empowerment. And that's what he's going to talk to us today, about what it takes to build a team that performs at its best, even when you're not there. Welcome to the show. Hi, Brendan. Welcome to the show. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey.
Hey, Dean. Great to be with you. Good day, everybody. So my name is Brendan, and my small claim to fame is I skippered a sailing boat in a round-the-world yacht race called the Clipper Race. Some of you may have even heard of it. And it's a really interesting race. It takes 11 months to do a full circumnavigation of the planet. It's raced on identical boats, which is pretty important because everyone's got the same stuff. So it's purely a race, not of the resources of the team, but of the people on board the vessel, because everything else is the same. And it's the world's only non-professional round the world race. So any one of you listening right now could download an application form. And you've got to go down to Portsmouth in the south coast of England. You've got to do 6 weeks of intensive training over the course of 2 years, having never sailed before in your life, mind you, and you can go off and do this race. It's kind of open to everybody. The teams are really diverse people. Each team's about 45 people, but there's only 20 beds on board the boat. So some people sign up for the whole experience and 11 months out of their life to go off and do this. Other people just sign up for one of several smaller sections. Mm-hmm. And each of the teams has a single professional sailor on board, like me. I was a professional sailor. That's what I did. That was my career. And I went through a long selection process. There are 160 applicants, and we sort of progressively whittled down to the final 10. I got one of those 10 spots. And my team was called Spirit of Australia. So, I can turn the accent back up whenever I have to. I am Australian originally, though I've been in the UK 25 years now. Yeah, I am. Yeah, but I'm fairly well anglicized now. This is home, this is my family are, and this is where the ashes will be scattered. So the crew, right, who sign up for this thing, super diverse bunch of people. Youngest was 17 on my boat, just left school.
Wow.
Oldest was 63. Mm-hmm. Had just had a hip replacement. So, a range of ages. We had a 60-40 split of men to women, though it's more like 50-50 in more recent editions, which is fantastic. 27 nationalities across the fleet. And just the whole spectrum of like life stories, careers, professions, just people from all walks of life. And I think the thing that makes them unique and want to sign up for this is you've got to be a little bit, well, I wouldn't say crazy to do this race, but most people probably would say that.
Yeah.
But you're going out to endure all these kind of these hardships. It's a huge challenge. It's a big life-changing ambition. And a lot of people say, I'm going to enjoy it when I'm doing it, but I know it's going to be hard, but I want to have done it. I want to have the achievement on my life. And I want to do this big thing. So yeah. But they know there's going to be a lot of adversity involved. This is a big, big challenge. And they've got to pay a fee to get on the race. Not free. You've got to, put your money where your mouth is. Can't just talk about it forever. Sacrifice your earning power for that period of time you're away at sea. And way more importantly, you've got to step away from family and children, caring commitments for parents, most important commitments in life. And there is real risk, there have been fatalities on this thing. It's not a wrapped in cotton wool experience. Part of the contract that all the crew have to sign, obviously, is part of it is a kind of no BS death waiver, saying we'll obviously take every precaution, every reasonable and, you know, highly regulated thing, of course, but it is an inherently dangerous thing, like going to climb Mount Everest or something else like that. And you have to accept those risks. And yeah, but I mean, going back to just being a skipper on this race, it's a huge challenge as a leader, and two key reasons. The first is you don't get to recruit your team.
Yeah.
You have no say in who they are.
Wow.
So so the people sign up for this race and they all train together as a big pool. And then about 3 months before the start, they get separated out into their 10 teams.
Wow.
And the race organizers take a lot of care to make sure there's an equal range of ages, a mixture of men and women, you know, and all the teams are basically even Stevens level playing field. And so, but yeah, as a skipper, I was quite literally handed a single sheet of A4, and it had 44 names and contact details on it. And I was said, there's your crew. You're going around the world with, good luck to you, mate. You know, have fun. Hope you all get on with each other. And that was quite a moment. I mean, any you know, listener, you know, you've been dropped into an incumbent team or a new business where everyone's already in place, you know that feeling. I can't really change things up. I've just got to work with what I've got.
Yeah, but yours is even more challenging than that, right? Because the team aren't even already functioning themselves. So you're new to the team, but also the team are new to each other. So that's really why I wanted to talk to you, because it is such a unique situation that you've got this level playing field and the teams are even across all the yachts, but you really are the difference that makes the difference, aren't you?
It's interesting because everyone comes along with, you know, and they understand they've signed up for this and eventually they're going to get put into one of these teams, and they, you know, perhaps they're not going to get everything that they want out of the race. They've got to understand that it's, you know, that they're now part of a collective and they've got to, you know, there's give and take there. But what I wasn't, I think I fell into this trap. I'm sure there'll be people nodding along to this because we all do it, I think. I've fallen into a trap where I assumed that other people, or the people in my team, they would think like me, they would be motivated like me, they would like to work like I did. And it's, you know, I think it's that cognitive bias we can fall into easily as leaders where, you know, it's called false consensus. But yeah, you understand everyone's different, but not quite how different when you're looking at the same thing. But yeah, I got I sent my crew out this survey, right? First thing I did, I had this little survey prepared. And I sent it all out to them once I had this list of their names. And I was asking everyone, you know, a bit of pre-engagement, as any good leader does with their team. You know, why have you signed up for this? What do you want to get out of it? What sort of role would you like to try on board the boat? What are your strengths? What, you know, and just trying to understand them and figure out how we can best work together and give you what you want. And, you know, and the answers I got back, right, they absolutely floored me by how radically different they were. And this is where it all came back. And it was, yeah, I thought everyone would have a sort of fairly similar, you know, response to what I wanted. But yeah, so I had, I mean, to put a contrast on it, one dude replies straight away, answers the question, only answers one question. He says, I'm here to win. Second place is the first loser. Like, hyper competitive.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of this red energy that I talk about, yeah.
Exactly, yeah, he's definitely firmly in that quadrant up there. Someone else said they're on the race to try and meet a romantic partner.
Oh, wow.
And everything in between, I mean, they're the outliers, of course, but... From all that data, from all that opinion. And I mean, people are really putting their lives on hold to go do this. They've got big expectations. And again, once they realize they're not that, you know, that the world doesn't revolve around them. They, you know, they know what they want to get out of this. So as a leader, you've got 44 sets of responses and you've got to then put together the culture and a team ethos and a way of working. You know, obviously number one priority is keep everyone safe. And there's no question, there's never a compromise there, of course. And once that baseline was set and maintained and met, it was about being high performing. You know, it is a race at the end of the day. Personally, I've never met someone who doesn't like winning. And my goal was always to get top three, podium finish at the very end, if not number one spot. You know, I was there to win and perform, but not, you know, win at all costs. You want to do it in the right kind of way, in a sustainable way. You know, it was about giving people what they wanted. And whilst I can't give everybody all the things they want all the time, because it's just impossible, you've got to come and create a culture and I suppose a way of working and a compromise that satisfies the most needs of the most people most of the time and And everyone's sort of happy to buy into that and align with that. And crucially, throw their discretionary effort beyond the minimum kind of expected requirement towards achieving that big goal and figuring out and sustaining that.
How did you create that culture then? You're talking about the culture. How did you create that?
Yeah, well, I mean, firstly, so it was getting these responses from people and understanding what it was. And I had my own ideas didn't radically change, but I realized I had to sort of adapt them slightly. So we got together before the race as a team and had, you know, I said, I want to be in sort of receive mode, but we've got to come up with a sort of a vision and some values together. And so the vision we came up with, it was a really nice turn of phrase. It was to do all we can to win the race and feel fulfilled, which we thought covered both aspects of it. I suppose the adventurous life affirming adventure side, but also, you know, this is a race. We're here to win, to do everything we can to achieve that goal. Whether we meet it or not, we'll time will tell. And everything sort of flowed from there. So, you know, we had our values of, you know, communication, trust. I mean, the sort of, I think they're probably fairly generic in terms of the types of values that most organizations have, but you know, they're an important shared reference for incentivizing positive behavior. And sometimes crucially, when you've got to call someone out, if mm-hmm. they're not conforming to those norms, you've all kind of agreed to, you know, other things too. You know, you have to have a clear strategy when you're sailing, but at the same, you know, you set out with a plan and the plan is updated and everyone understands what it is and what their part in achieving it is. But at the same time, the weather, which dictates all of your kind of meta decision-making, is always changing, and you're always operating with coarse grain data that's always changing, you know, and you've got to place bets, you know, on where you're going to put the boat. So you have to be very reactive. There's an interesting duality of sort of strategic planning and then quick reactivity and adaptation. You know, we had to also create a culture, because it is all about the people, of coaching, development, upskilling, training, because this wasn't a race of 10 boats. It was a race of 10 teams, and it was going to be the team who could do consistently the teamwork stuff the best. Over 11 months, that was going to be the team that would come out on top.
And the minimum amount of time people spent with you?
So the makeup of the race is, yeah, you can sign up for just one leg or perhaps a couple of legs, or you can do the whole lot. So on the race, the shortest leg was 18 days. Mm-hmm. That was Rio de Janeiro to Cape Town. The longest single leg was the North Pacific, which was about between 32, 35 days. So yeah, that's the sort of broadly how long people spent on the boat. I had, there were 20 slots on the boat where, you know, 20 beds. I had 10 crew who went the whole way around the world. So they were my, I suppose, consistent team. Yeah,
like your senior leadership team almost.
And then the other team members kind of came and went depending mm-hmm. on how much they'd signed up for and which legs.
That's amazing. So how did you keep yourself motivated and how did you motivate the team?
I mean, motivation was a massive issue on all of the boats, because it's physically draining. You hit exhaustion point pretty quick. And when you've got to go and do a sail change at 4 a.m. and it's cold and wet and you've only just gotten to sleep, getting people not just to comply, but to understand why it was necessary and want to do it was going to be key. So yeah, to keep people motivated, firstly, I had to make sure that everyone felt like they were being invested in and they didn't feel like a necessarily present labor force just there to kind of do the work. And, you know, they were the arms and the hands there to execute the strategy. People feeling motivated was, one, keeping the cadence of communication high, making sure that people understood how we were doing in the race, what our strategy was. And every day we had a daily meeting and it was all about making sure there was absolute clarity in people's minds, what we were doing, what's happened in the last 24 hours, what learnings can we take, and what is the next, absolute clarity on what the next 48 hours look like, which was our sort of short-term planning horizon. And so by doing that was huge for us. And not all the boats did that, believe it or not. There are other skippers who the strategy lived firmly in, and they just told the team what they needed to know. Mm. And I don't think they were deliberately keeping in the dark. That was just their style.
Yeah.
And so for me, I needed to make sure that all the team, if they wanted to feel bought into this strategy and feel like they were characters in this this compelling narrative that they needed all that information all the time. So yeah, that was really important. The other thing was, on a longer term, I realized that the journey most of the team wanted to be on wasn't just about sailing around the world geographically, getting from A to B. It was about them building their skill set, building mastery of this new, you know, skill that they were in this adventure. So it was about making sure that I dedicated more and more of my time to investing in them, you know, training them, delegating them, you know, and just helping them to achieve their goal of becoming a more rounded, more skilled sailor, which is, you know, passing on my expertise. Keeping myself motivated, I wouldn't say it was, you know, gung-ho all the time. I'm not a red-colored personality. I think I'm whatever color it is, it's the sort of the reflective data-driven one. I think that's great.
Right, that's the blue, cool blue, show me the details. Yeah, but there's a lot of caring in there as well, if you're with the people as well. So cool blue, earth green as well in there.
That's what I said. I'll be honest with you, the motivation for me to do the race was to win it. But interestingly, and it's a story here, I think I fell into a trap, and I think most leaders can probably relate to this. There was a point in the race where I let my emotional state, my attitude, I suppose, get too closely attached to the performance of the boat. And we're getting an update on our performance every 6 hours. We get this, an email comes in on our satellite system that tells us how we did versus mm-hmm. our rivals. And yeah, I mean, it would really go up. It would fluctuate a lot. We're all in different weather, but weirdly, when the numbers were good and then, you know, the little boxes showed up green, I would, I'd sort of show up in the right kind of way, you know, empowering and giving, you know, encouragement and enthusiasm. And it was, but 6 hours later, the numbers will show up red for reasons beyond our control. You know, we're all doing our best, but you always just kind of, I would sit there and get like really angry. And I feel self-conscious sort of telling you, but the pressures that you're under there, whilst they're not an excuse, they do bring out a side of you that you don't often see when you're in a more sort of stable environment at home, where you've got stress relief and a partner you can come home and vent to and take a time out from the pressures of work. But anyway, so I would get really quite angry, and not angry at the team, sort of internally, like, and that frustration and that catastrophization process. And so here's the thing. I'd then go up on deck and immediately pull back all that control. I suppose figuratively pull the like Superman underpants on the outside and sort of put the leader cape on and go, right, leadership time. Here's a problem. Time for me to solve it. And really, because it was this volatility, but on this massively compressed time cycle, you know, it was ripping apart the fabric of the team. And honestly, it was in my blind spot, you know. And I think as leaders, we've all got these things, and sometimes it takes a bit of heart, you know, well-intentioned, hopefully, but harsh feedback to kind of illuminate this and sort of hold the mirror up. But yeah, I was fed back this by the team, basically told this is unacceptable behavior. You know, we expect more from you as a leader. We can't
wow,
exist
that's
like this.
Great that they could, but that you provided a safe environment that they felt they could do that.
I think even if I hadn't, they would have done it. I mean, the type of people who sign up for this race, they're not sort of wilting wallflowers. They are, they're quite, you know, people who have clear boundaries in their life.
And what did you do to sort of snap out of that then?
Well, I felt sorry for myself for a little while. And here's the thing, because they all, you know, we're all great, Dee. I mean, everyone is. However monk-like we try and pretend we are, we're all great at telling ourselves stories and creatively self-justifying our own behaviors. And, you know, that old chestnut, we judge other people by their actions and ourselves by our intentions. But yeah, I think at the time I thought, well, this is really unfair and they've all ganged up on me and I'm this and I'm just, no, but again, this is, maybe it's an avoidance of the truth, but you know, I knew deep down they were right, but you can, again, creatively self-justify, I'm a performance standards driven leader, and when we're meeting our targets and our expectations, I want to celebrate that. And when we're not, then I've got to make sure that we close the delta, and it's, but you know, it's just mental gymnastics, really. They're absolutely right, justified in what they're saying. But yeah, I did snap out of it. They gave me that feedback. I didn't handle it brilliantly at first, but they gave it to me again in port and said, this is really important. And I did take it on board, and you know, I had to have a bit of a soul search, and in Rio. But then when we regrouped and set off on the next leg of the race, I'd taken that on board. And the key takeaway from that was for me that your mood becomes their mood and your attitude becomes their attitude. And the shadow that you cast as a leader, which you can't turn off and everyone else lives in it, is way bigger than we think it is. It certainly was for me. It's probably compounded by the fact that no one could be more than 20 meters away from me at any given time. So they can't sort of just get.
It's just more obvious, but I think most
it's more obvious.
Yeah, every leader does this, but they don't know that they're doing that. So this is the importance of role modeling, isn't it? And doing what you say you want to do and living the values and doing that. Fantastic. So that's about motivating yourself and your team. And tell us a little bit about delegation as well, because when I have listened to you talk before, which is why I invited you onto the show, it's fantastic talk. And just how you manage this new team just amazed me. So one of the things that was really impressive is the whole delegation piece and how you let go, because it really is a life and death situation on your yacht, isn't it? It's just, high risk. So how did you go about delegation?
Yeah, delegation, sort of empowerment and creating a team that took ownership was really key. I mean, at a bare minimum, I've got to be able to go to sleep for, you know, ideally 6+ hours in a 24-hour cycle. So I had to know that at a minimum, while that's going on, everything was being done safely up on deck and that the crew would come and wake me up if any one of these conditions changed or something had happened. So that's the sort of starting baseline for the beginning of the race. I've got to get them to the point where at least that can happen. But over the course of this race, I realized that before we got to the really, I suppose, risky part of the race, which was the first leg in the Southern Ocean, I had to get them to the point where operationally they could sail the boat without me in the event that I was killed or incapacitated or washed over the side. You know, that they had to be able to do that. And to not do that, to kind of stay in that super directive leader mode where everything has to come through you, you call all the shots, everyone is sort of passively just waiting to be told what to do. You know, you're always the key decision maker, but everything hinges on you. You know, it's kind of single point of failure. And, it's like the founder who does everything themselves and then wonders why their business isn't worth all that much. Mm-hmm. Because everything hinges on them. So to do that would actually be to rob them in a way, in long-term way, of the ability to get to safety if I got taken out, which would be, I think, a negligent thing to do. But the more, we got to that level, but by, I'd say, the 2/3 of the way around the world race, I'd realized this approach had become a real superpower of the team versus our rivals. I hadn't abdicated any responsibility, but I'd probably invested the most in the team, in the training, the development, the upskilling, the giving people the clarity and the confidence and the operational independence to act autonomously whilst within, and I stress this, the very strict safety and regulatory framework that we always had to work within. Within that, you know, they, for example, when the wind was increasing and it was time to change from a bigger set of sails down to a smaller one, where normally it would be, you know, that would be my call to make. And I'd say, when we do it, the crew had full decision-making autonomy. I told them what they needed to notice, what the data looked like, how to sort of weigh up whether to make this call now or give it another 20 minutes, say. And I just said, and then you just inform me that you're doing it, but I trust you, you go and do it. But it had a few key benefits. One, it was that it's intrinsic motivator. We've all got, like, no one likes to feel super micromanaged, particularly around something that is their core competency. And it can become personal, can breed resentment if people just feel like you're unnecessarily sort of overwatching them. Second, it freed up my time to focus on the strategy, focus on the well-being of the team, to the performance, the almost the deep thinking that it isn't quite so hands-on, but it's that layer of work that's sort of adding value at a higher level, rather than being there with your long screwdriver and sort of tinkering with everything. Yeah, it was about sort of that stepping back and thinking strategically. And as I said, finally, it was death. We were put to the ultimate test, really, in a scenario on this race that we could never really have foreseen before the start, the crossing the North Pacific Ocean. So that's the longest and coldest and most dangerous leg of the race by far. and just as we're about 700 miles off the coast of Japan. So we'd left China, we'd sailed down the Yellow Sea, we'd rounded the southern tip of Japan, and we're heading for San Francisco. So, you know, it's a long way away. We're 700 miles into the Pacific. A big storm came, and the fleet are racing together, and one of our rivals, one of our competitors, they had a knockdown. So a knockdown is really about the worst thing that can happen on a sailing boat. So a big wave hits the boat right on its side and rolls it right over in the water. You know, tons of water sort of crashing across the deck.
Wow.
And the boat came back upright, but their skipper, who was on deck at the time, he'd been sort of feet washed out from under him, pushed up against a steel fitting, and his leg broken.
Oh.
Bones through the skin. It was a really bad one. He was taken below, sedated by, you know, with morphine, his leg put in a splint. Japanese Coast Guard send out one of their fast patrol ships to evacuate him, take him back to Japan for treatment. And the race regulators and the race committee and the stakeholders who sort of control this thing, their plan was that they would ask one of the skippers from one of the other boats to transfer across onto this stricken vessel and firstly make sure that the evacuation of the injured skipper to the Japanese Coast Guard ship was done sort of safely. It's dangerous bringing boats up against each other at sea. And then they would stay on that boat, and then they would skipper that boat in tandem with their own boat the rest of the way across the North Pacific to San Francisco, still through some, you know, horrendous weather that is sort of out there. And the reason they asked my boat to turn around was because that was their eventual ask of me.
Wow.
And the reason they asked was they knew, everyone around the race knew, out of all the teams, mine was the one that was entrusted, had the best training, had the most ownership. They were the ones that we'd optimized for operational excellence and independence right from the start. And really, they were the team that could, whilst no longer racing, that pressure removed, they could sail that boat to the safety standard that we demanded at all times, without question, without their leader being there, calling the shots, telling everyone what to do, because of what we built.
Wow, that's amazing, isn't it? Because you would never have expected that to happen. And how many days were you off your boat then for?
I think it was about 20, 22, 23 more days.
Gosh.
Now, it's not like we just went separate ways and hundreds of miles apart or anything. The rule was we stayed within 15 miles of each other, and that's the range of our radio sets, so that we could be in constant communication. So whilst I stayed in overall charge, if you like, of the strategy and the sail plans and so on, I mean, you're 15 miles away. I might as well have been on the moon for all the help I could actually offer them with my hands. But here's the thing, Dee. So we got there. We got there safely, and, you know, we went through some horrendous weather, and there were a few survival moments, but we got there in the end. And reflecting on that experience and taking what we'd learned and what I'd learned, and we fed it back into our kind of performance culture. And the conclusion that the team came to, and we talked about this, like, what's my role now? Because we get to the other side, and we were given some recompense for the points that we didn't earn on the last leg because we weren't racing. And so we were still in with a shot. We could still kind of get, you know, high position in the race. We talked about it, and basically the team said, we can sail the boat without you, and we know that now, but we can't race the boat without you.
Mm.
That's the bit you add. That's the level on top. And that's where we need you focused. And that's what I did. And over the course of the rest of that race, we cleaned up.
Wow.
We put in our best and most consistent performances, and just over and over and over again. And we won this race by the biggest margin it had been won by. And I think the things that really contributed to that win often weren't the things that we set out at the start, you know, and we just stuck to our values and it all just went brilliantly. It was the stuff we learned from the adverse experiences along the way that sort of forged us into the team that we were, not to sort of sound, you know, over dramatic, but there was a catalyst in those moments that forced me to change something, change the way I approached a problem, to change the way we work together. And that's what led to the success in the end. So without those moments, I mean, I'd like to think we still would have got there, but I don't think they were the forced moments of development. And it was in those moments, I would say, that the outcomes of the 10 on paper, the same teams, where the outcomes diverged, was in the aftermath of their setbacks, their challenges, their moments of change, their moments of transition, their moments of crisis sometimes, and how they dealt with those things and responded to them. That's where their sort of destiny was set on the leaderboard at the end.
That's amazing, isn't it? Just to think about how you all change with the new information, like continual improvement all of the time, taking that on board. But yeah, and when you're in those bad moments, to somehow hold on to the fact that you know this is going to do you good in the future, you'll look back on this and go, oh, I'm so pleased this happened. You don't at the moment though, I
expect. No, exactly. Yeah, that's the next level. I'm not even sure I'm there now, but I suppose you've got to keep the faith at some point though, right? You've got to keep some belief inside of you. And I think I'm a real believer that, you know, if you really believe something is true and you really believe that you can do something, then you will see opportunities to make it happen, and you'll be able to frame adversity as something that you do learn from. But if you don't have that belief inside, then I think you just notice the roadblocks, and you'll notice off ramps, and there is something about, call it pigheadedness, but you've just got to keep the faith and keep the belief what I'm doing is worthwhile, and we push forward.
And the team will pick up on that, won't they?
They do. That's it.
Fantastic. There's so much more to it, and you've written a book about this, haven't you?
I have. Yeah, you've heard the best bit today. But look, my book, Team Spirit, is out there in all the normal places. And yeah, if you like it, it's an intersection between the story of sailing around the world and also, I suppose, the leadership and teamwork lessons and frameworks that really enabled us to work in this kind of way.
And I think that's really important. So, okay, we're not sailing around the world, but all of the elements you're talking about are exactly what everyday leaders face, maybe not in quite such extreme conditions, but everybody has these ups and downs and these moments of how much do I empower? How much do I delegate? So really recommend that people go and get that book and have a look at that. And before we close, is there anything that we haven't covered? I know there's loads more to cover, but anything you think we could talk about that we haven't done, or any questions I could have asked you that I haven't done?
Something that I would say is, looking back on the race, for me as a leader, it was about managing tensions. I think solving problems and managing the tensions of leadership. And that's sort of how I choose to think about it and talk about it now, because there's so many asks made of us, and they're not mutually exclusive, but there's always a balance to be found. For example, like you just expressed, you want to delegate and entrust and empower your team, but at the same time, you're still ultimately accountable for their output, whatever it is. You want to be an inclusive, thoughtful decision maker who, you know, just gets the wisdom of the team, all that stuff. But at the same time, if you're trying to overseek consensus on everything, you'll just be slow, and leads to procrastination. You've got to be across the detail of like the day-to-day operations, but at the same time, think strategically, keep the short-term goals kind of going to keep the engine of the business running. But at the same time, you've got these long-term transformations. Oh God, what are we going to do about AI and all that sort of stuff over there? Managing those tensions, being a good human leader who's sort of friendly and likable, but at the same time got to have those difficult conversations when it's required, and how you sort of weave in the middle there and try and manage those things. That's for me, finding the balance there, and often it was by over-indexing one way and then maybe the other way, but eventually trying to find a sort of a middle ground. I think what people valued the most by the end of the race in my leadership, for all its faults and failings, was probably consistency. And it was that we know what we expect from you, and we know what we're going to get from you. And in this world of kind of rapid evolving change that was outside the boat, the fact that I could be the rock at the center of the team that could be relied upon, kind of whatever was going on, never getting too high when things were going well, never getting down too down when things weren't going well, but being that sort of always that stabilizing influence, just gave them the safety, the psychological safety, and the feeling of, a physical safety that just allowed them to focus on performing and just executing, you know, the best they could.
Fantastic. That's so great to hear your story, just a little bit of it. But thank you for sharing that with us today. Highly recommend everyone goes out and gets that book. It's a fantastic read. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Dee. Thank you, everyone. Enjoy the rest of your week.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you, Brendan. What an amazing story. There's loads of things we can take and use right away with our teams this week. Real empowerment is built step by step. Deliberately is not an accident. And thank you for being such a great role model on that. Thank you for listening to The Debrief Show. We really appreciate it. You can find more information on YouTube. Just search for The Debrief Show under Dee Clayton, or on podcasts like Apple and Spotify. We're there on The Debrief Show. So come and join us, follow us, or share this episode with someone else who you think will really benefit from it. And until next time, keep bringing out the best in yourself, your teams, and your communications.